Well, what is he trying to convey? What is this point?
What comes to mind is be still and know that I am God.
Yes, yes. I think that's right. Be still and know that I am God.
And that's where all the action starts.
Yeah.
The dance.
Yes. Yeah. Except for the point, the still point, there would be no dance. And there is only the dance. So there is this paradox. You can think about the hub of a wheel, where there's a stillness, and everything turns around it. And all this, trust me, we're gonna end up at Chartres in the labyrinth, and ultimately Dante, because we're moving towards Dante tomorrow. This is very close to Dante's image at the very summit of the paradox. But somehow, and of course, this is an attempt to describe what is indescribable, an attempt to put images to what is without image, that is God. And so God is that still place that generates all activity. This is one way, at least, of trying to get at it, that there is this stillness at the very center of reality, and out of that place comes the dance of the cosmos. And Eliot is trying to describe this.
I just immediately came to mind Charles Williams, I think the greater Trumps.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Yes.
Image.
That's right where I was going.
Oh.
Because that's where Eliot got this image.
Mm-hmm.
There is a novelist, poet, and essayist named Charles Williams, who was part of what's called the Inklings. Yeah.
What if the physicist's concept of the Big Bang had been around at the time of Eliot? I wonder if he would have thought, well, maybe that's what the physicists can't talk about.
Yes, and physicists, many physicists, we got into this territory a little bit yesterday, and many physicists are also struggling to find language. And of course there's mathematical language, but to try to translate it into lay terms for this experience of that Big Bang out of which all things come. The moment before the Big Bang, I mean, even to say the moment, puts us into a temporal framework. Because there was no moment. Time, in a sense, begins as the universe begins with that explosion. And how do you talk about, well, what was before?
The mathematical expression is when things are reduced to a singularity, so that beyond that is nothing, and from that is where the equations lead.
Yes. And you can feel the poets and writers and artists often trying to arrive through image at this same place. And so going back to Charles Williams, Charles Williams' novel, The Greater Trumps, uses the metaphor of the tarot cards. And he envisions these figures that are involved in a dance, a perpetual dance, all these different archetypes involved in a dance. And the central figure is the fool. This is where we've landed at Holden. The central figure is the fool. And everybody who looks, there's this sort of magical, literal figures who are on a flat board. And these figures represent all the tarot cards. In a sense, they represent everything in the cosmos. And all of them are in motion. The only one that seems not to be in motion is the fool. And the fool is the zero card, is the one that you can't find a place for. In a sense, is the still point. And what's interesting in The Greater Trumps, Charles Williams has a character named Sybil, really. Sybil, who is prophet, and Sybil is the one who leads Virgil into the underworld in the Aeneid. The spokesperson for Apollo, god of light. Sybil is in the Charles Williams novel this extraordinary character who is very simple, very quiet, a very ordinary Englishwoman, and yet is a person of extraordinary compassion and openness, is without fear. is totally aligned with the will of God in her own very quiet way. And when Sybil is with all the other people in the novel who are looking at this dance, these dancing figures, and someone says, well, there's the fool standing still, Sybil says, well, I don't see the fool. I don't see anything standing still. And then they ask, well, what do you see? Well, she says, I see the fool actually moving from place to place, just like a hummingbird almost, moving so quickly, always filling the empty spot. The fool is, in fact, in motion. So, simultaneously, the fool is always at the center of things, always the one who, around which the whole dance moves. But yes.
Is there any significance that the center of anything moving is rotating?
Mm-hmm.
Is that any significance?
I think so. That and it depends on your theology, I guess. That in and I'm trying not to get too distracted here from Chartres Cathedral, but. If one thinks of the Trinity, on the one hand, there is a sense of absolute stillness and rest. That God, God is in some ways at rest, is complete, is whole. And yet, does not the image of the Trinity suggest relationship? And does not relationship suggest, and does not love itself suggest movement? That there is this unending flow of energy, put it that way, unending flow of love that exists in the Trinity. And it's from that place that all things come to be. I mean, you could say that that's that center from which all things are moving, possibly. Now, if we think about Merton's comment about Bart trying to awaken this divine Sophianic Mozart in himself, trying to align himself. What was the phrase? He describes this hidden Sophianic Mozart as the central wisdom that comes in tune with the divine and cosmic music. So coming in tune with the divine and cosmic music. He's using language, of course, out of music, a sense of attunement, of being in tune, harmonious with, in proportion with, this underlying pattern, rhythm, that moves all things. Now, my suggestion is that Chartres Cathedral, the great cathedrals, great architecture, in some ways, also, what we experience in these places is something akin to that same feeling of that these are places that are built according to that hidden Sophianic Mozart within each of us. In fact, there was an intentionality about that in the Middle Ages, that they were built according to geometrical proportions, what many people call sacred geometries. And when you walk into such a place, so how many of you have been to Chartres? A few of you have been to Chartres. And I'll be curious about your experience. And I'll talk a little bit today about my own experience, because my wife and I had a chance to do a week-long pilgrimage, really, to Chartres, in part to walk the labyrinth at Chartres. This was with a group called Veriditas, based in Grace Episcopal Cathedral in San Francisco. Lauren Artress is somebody who has brought the labyrinth tradition, one of the people who's brought the labyrinth tradition back into our culture. And Lauren was leading this trip. So Chartres, going into Chartres, is something of that same experience of being in a place where you do experience something of this, these cosmic proportions. One critic writes that Chartres is an embodiment of St. Bernard's theology is an architectural manifestation of wisdom, of this underlying truth. Now, Chartres, like the cathedral in Paris, is dedicated to whom?
Mary.
Chartres is Notre Dame. And there was a reawakened interest in, I mean, that's putting it far too mildly, in Mary and in this feminine divine quality in the Middle Ages, 12th, 13th century. St. Bernard, profoundly devoted to Mary, wrote endless sermons on the Song of Songs, which is this extraordinarily erotic text from the Old Testament, which of course was interpreted to be about the relationship between the soul and God, or the individual Christian and Christ, or the church as a body and Christ. And so Mary becomes an embodiment of this Sophia, of this wisdom figure. And these cathedrals are built in honor of her, and also really as an embodiment in some ways of her and of all that she represents. So the beauty, I'm quoting now, the beauty for the 12th and 13th centuries had two characteristics: consonance of parts, or proportion, harmony and balance, and luminosity. Luminosity, it illuminates, it brings light. So beauty is proportion and balance and luminosity. So beauty is intended to be luminous, is clear, there's a transparency about it. Through beauty, we experience, we are enlightened in some ways. The stained glass windows, replacing walls with windows in Gothic cathedrals, was an image of this, in fact. So, if I back up a step, as you walk into Chartres Cathedral, you are walking in from the west end. This is the traditional way into the cathedral. You walk in from the west end. And why west? What's the significance of west? Symbolic significance of west.
The
significance might be looking to the east rather than entering from the west.
You are facing east.
Yeah.
And why is that? Why is that significant?
Jerusalem.
Well, Jerusalem, traditionally for Europe, is to the east.
Sun, source of light.
And the sunrise. You are orienting towards sunrise. Our word orient, in fact, right? We know that one meaning of the word orient is the east. And it's the east because from the perspective of the west, it's toward the sunrise. And so by extension, the word orient also becomes a word meaning, of course, how we orient ourselves. We are oriented, we know where we are, by the sunrise, and symbolically by that light. It's a really good example of how symbols work. So I do this all the time with my freshmen. Symbols are just everything rooted in the body, in the earth. Symbols grow out of our relationship to the earth. Why is the forest such a profound symbol of wandering, of wilderness, of being lost? Anybody wandered through a forest?
And aren't people traditionally buried so that they're facing east?
That's the tradition. There's all sorts of traditions around east and west. John Donne has a beautiful poem, Good Friday riding westward. The whole point of the poem is that it is Good Friday, and he is actually facing the west when he ought to be oriented to the east. And yet, the west is also that place where Christ is dying. I mean, it goes on and on, the way Donne, who's constantly punning and so on, does. But he's working with that same idea. And so you enter the cathedral from the west. Right above the door is an image of Christ, Christ as judge. But Christ inside what's called the Vesica Pisces. Anybody familiar with that term? The image is of, it looks something like this. And you have the figure of Christ within that, right above the door. And the vesica Pisces, by Pisces, of course, fish, the vessel of fish. So this is Christ. If you continue this, what you get is, I mean, there are a series of three circles, and this is the central circle that is created. When you overlap two circles, you get this circle in the middle. And this represents, on the one hand, this is Christ in the body of Mary, in the body of the cathedral. The whole cathedral is the body of Mary, the womb of Mary, from which Christ is born. Mary is the Theotokos, the God-bearer. And so the whole cathedral is that body. And as you're walking in, you're with Christ in the body of Mary in some way. But Christ is also the judge. And so you are entering from the west. The west is the setting sun. Setting sun represents life or death. Death. Yeah.
Darkness.
Darkness. The end of things. So there's also an apocalyptic sense, both for the individual, but also for the collective. So you walk in. There's a tremendous paradox here. You're walking, in a sense, out of your old life. You go in through the doors of that cathedral. And there is a way in which you are dying to that old life. And you come in. You've gone through that western door. And in many of the traditional cathedrals in Europe, there was the baptistry was actually outside across the street. If you know Florence, the baptistry is across the street. And you would be baptized at the Easter Vigil. And then you would enter from the baptistry, literally enter into the body of Mary, which is also the body of the church, the body of Christ. And you walk into Chartres Cathedral, and you look up, and on a nice sunny day at least, the light is streaming through these stained glass windows. And those stained glass windows depict the entire story of the Bible. Genesis, Garden of Eden, creation, to Book of Revelations, Apocalypse. So you are inside all of human history, in a sense. Keep in mind that in the 12th and 13th centuries, most people were illiterate. Mass was in Latin. And so the cathedral was a little bit like, this is a terrible analogy, but it's like a comic book. It's an illustrated version of the entire Bible, which is all of human history. So there is a temporality, there is a time frame here, and you can go from window to window and experience step by step, there's Adam and Eve, and there's Moses, and there's the birth of Christ, and right around to the end. So it is temporal, but there's also a sense in which it is all contained in one moment. It is all there. It is all happened. In a sense, you're at the still point of the turning point inside that space. And so you have this light pouring through these images. And each image is human, and the light pouring through it is also a beautiful symbol of the light of God, the light of Christ, which is, in a sense, broken by those stained glass windows. Stained has both positive and negative connotations to it. The light, the purity of that light, is in a sense broken by the stained glass windows, but it's precisely the color of the windows that allow us to experience this story, the meaning of all that light. This is the light, Jesus is the light, coming into incarnation, coming into image, into form. And we see Jesus, in a sense, in all of those images. Adam, Eve, Moses, the whole shebang. It's all Jesus. It's all within this same space. And where do we find ourselves? Within it. We are held within it, inside that cathedral. Now you walk into the cathedral, let's pretend that this is the west, and you come in through the doors, set of doors. And if you walk in, maybe a quarter of the way, you would look up, you'd see this magnificent rose window above you, Christ and Mary. And If you then walked, this is quite lovely, if you walked a little bit further, you would see on the floor of the nave the labyrinth, which is stretching from pillar to pillar, 42 feet in diameter. 42 feet in diameter. And I'll actually pass around this book. I wish that I had PowerPoint and all these images and so on, and I don't, and I apologize for that. But so you'll just have to look through this book on Chart, and let's see if I can locate it. I can send this around in two directions. And I'll actually, if you would do me a favor and thumb through, you'll find where, there it is. That's what it looks like. And I'll send another image the other way. So, the labyrinth is there on the floor, built into the floor of the cathedral, around the year 1200, 1220. And the labyrinths were built on many of these cathedrals in the Middle Ages, 12th, 13th century. Folks who studied this argue that if you took the west wall of the cathedral at Chartres, and if you could lie it down on the floor of the nave, the rose window would lie directly on top of the labyrinth. There are those who argue that, in fact, the entire cathedral was arranged proportionally around the labyrinth. The labyrinth was, in a sense, it's not literally the central point. A Gothic cathedral is laid out in terms of a cross. There's a long nave, and then, I believe it's the transept that comes across. But the labyrinth, this at least is the argument, that there's a way in which the labyrinth is also that still point within the still point. And the labyrinth, it's important to keep in mind that when we're talking about labyrinth, we're not talking about a maze. What's a maze?
Confusing.
Why is it confusing?
You can get stuck.
You can get lost. There are dead ends.
Minotaurs.
Minotaurs? Yes, I don't want to lose track of that. Okay. You'll see that in my title for the talk today, it included the word monster.
Oh, that's right.
Right? Something shards, labyrinth, monsters. And the Minotaur is, that's the monster. And we will get there, I promise. So, the understanding is that these labyrinths, and no one knows for certain, but Chartres was one of the great pilgrimage centers in Europe. It was one of the places that people went on the pilgrimage to Santiago. It was also a place that people would stop on the road literally to Jerusalem. But most people in the 12th, 13th century couldn't go to Jerusalem. And so these pilgrimage sites became an alternative to going all the way, the literal way to Jerusalem. So one of the things that's raised when we're talking about Chartres and a labyrinth is this whole notion of pilgrimage, the function of pilgrimage. People would literally walk to Chartres, they would enter the cathedral, and then they would walk the labyrinth, apparently sometimes on their knees, stone cold floor on their knees. So it becomes a microcosm of the pilgrimage. Now let's pause briefly. What's the function, what's the point of a pilgrimage? Why do we go on pilgrimages? Maybe some of you are here at Holden on pilgrimage.
A journey to the heart of God.
Hmm?
A journey to the heart of God.
A journey to the heart of God. Yeah, you're looking for something, presumably. There is a desire for something. There is a hunger. There is a need. There is a wound. There is a need for healing, whatever it might be. If you've got everything you want, why bother journeying? And sometimes it seems that it's important that we literally take ourselves out of our context and go somewhere else. Whether we call this a desert experience, Jesus, 40 days in the wilderness, 40 years Exodus in the desert, and so on.
Mountaintop.
Or the mountaintop. All these different images. for getting ourselves out of our context and going somewhere else. I said, my wife and I went on a pilgrimage to Chartres. And it was a very intentional. It wasn't, we thought of it not simply as a tourist trip. It was, there was something about Chartres, there was something about that space, something about the labyrinth. We felt that would help us to deepen our relationship with each other and deepen our relationship with God. Now there's a paradox here. Do we need to go anywhere actually to meet God? No.
He comes to us.
Exactly, exactly. There's this wonderful story that's told about a man in this small Russian village many years ago who was poor and trying to find a way to make a living and was also a seeker. He had a dream, and in the dream, he was told that if he went to a particular bridge in Prague, if he walked to Prague, and if he went to this bridge, and at the base of the bridge, if he dug, he would find gold. He would find that which would satisfy him for the rest of his life. He wakes up, and inspired by the dream, he walks all the way to Prague, a pilgrimage to Prague. And he finds the bridge that was in his dream. And at the base of the bridge, he starts to dig. And, perhaps not surprisingly, a policeman comes up. What are you doing? And the man reluctantly explains, I had this dream that if I dug here, I would find gold, and it would satisfy me and my family for the rest of my life. And the policeman starts to laugh at him and says, that's insane. That's sheer folly. You believe in your dreams? The policeman says, you know, I had a dream last night about this guy in a Russian village who had treasure buried beneath his bed. You think I'm going to go to this place and find out if there's treasure buried beneath the bed? It's ridiculous. The light goes on. The man goes back home, goes to his bedroom, digs down below, and finds the buried treasure. It's a beautiful allegory. Beautiful allegory. On the one hand, no reason to leave. On the other hand, he had to leave in order to learn that there's, as Dorothy would say, no place like home.
Yeah. Isn't there a sense of pilgrimage and the mini journey to a church every Sunday morning?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in one sense, this is the good Protestant in me. There's no need to go anywhere. God is available all the time, everywhere. And yet, absolutely, absolutely, it is a pilgrimage. It is, you walk into that space, if that space holds this for you, and through whatever it might be in that service, through the liturgy, through rhythms, through patterns, through music, through word, through silence, through sacraments, there is a reminder, a homecoming. That's my own experience. Yeah.
What are the lines from T.S. Eliot that return and discover? How does that go? Return and discover the place for the first time.
Yes, yes. At the end of the four quartets, Eliot writes, we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. It's the same idea. And so you enter that cathedral and you walk the labyrinth, and the labyrinth is, again, not a maze, it is unicursal, meaning it's one path. It's one winding, circuitous path. And while you're walking it, there is a temporal process. This is like a story. There's a beginning point, and you wander around, and it feels like you're getting lost. There's so many turnings, it feels like you're getting lost. And yet, if you follow that path, it will lead you into the center. And in the labyrinth at Chartres, and the labyrinth at Chartres, at the center of it is a six-petaled rose. And that rose is the symbol of Mary, the symbol of love, and ultimately of, on the one hand, human love, erotic love, the way we still think of roses, but also the symbol of divine love. As we will see if we get there tomorrow, at the end of the Divine Comedy, Dante images paradise as a white rose, and everybody is held, we make up that rose. And so you arrive at that center, and that is the still point of the turning world. Yes.
Where does the word come from, pilgrimage? What?
It is, I have to double check. It's a Latin-based word, and I believe it actually has to do with walking or wandering. I think pilgrim comes from that root, wandering. Our word vagrant, a different root, but vagrant also has this sense of wandering, as you know, it might suggest. And so extravagant is the same root. Extravagant is like extra wandering. Something that's extravagant seems to go outside the bounds. So now we want to make sure we get to the Minotaur. How are we doing on time?
11:30.
11:30? Mm-hmm. Okay, we got 20 minutes. So let's backtrack here and think about, when we think about labyrinths, the word Minotaur came up. Okay. What's that association? What's that labyrinth all about? Do you remember?
Oh gosh, Greek mythology's been a few years.
There's going to be a quiz. So let's backtrack. Yes, our Greek.
And we'll believe you no matter what you say.
Right, because no one else will remember.
I have a terrible quest, isn't it?
Are you speaking about the mean Minotaur or?
Yes.
It was like the people would get in there and they never come out of there.
Yes.
It had the purpose of just trapping people.
Yeah, the Minotaur, let's see how far back in the story do we want to go. We're on the island of Crete in Greece, and King Minos has been offered, I believe by the god Poseidon, god of the sea, this magnificent white bull that he is supposed to sacrifice to Minos. And Minos finally is unwilling to do it. He is unwilling to surrender that which actually does belong to the god. And as a punishment, Poseidon has Minos's queen fall in love with this magnificent white bull. In order to couple with the bull, the queen goes to the craftsman Danaus, who serves the king, and has Daedalus create this big artificial cow. At any rate, the queen mates with the bull. The child of their mating is the Minotaur, half human, half beast. Minos, horrified by this, but unwilling to kill the Minotaur, which is product of the gods in some way, has Daedalus create a labyrinth and puts the Minotaur at the center of the labyrinth, hidden away. We could spend a lot of time on this myth and the power, this idea of unwilling to sacrifice, unwilling to surrender, and then having made one mistake, wanting to hide it. Mm-hmm. And so what Minos does is he has conquered Athens, and he forces the people of Athens to send, I think it's 6 youth, young men, from Athens to Crete. And those youth are then fed to the Minotaur. Until Theseus comes along. Theseus, the son of the king. And Theseus arrives. And the daughter of Minos, Ariadne, falls in love with Theseus. And at night comes to Theseus and says, I can tell you how to work your way through the labyrinth to the Minotaur. What you do at that point is up to you. You're the hero. And so, of course, the famous story is that Ariadne gives Theseus a thread. And by having the thread, he's able to wind his way using the thread until finally he arrives at the center, and he meets the Minotaur, and he slays the Minotaur. He's the hero. He follows the thread back out and whisks Ariadne off, and they don't live happily ever after because he abandons her. Another story. But that's the story, the original story of the labyrinth, which is actually a maze. There's an argument that the labyrinth that we see in Star and others was actually created as a dancing pattern. It was originally a dance in Greece that was then adapted onto a static form. And in fact, the labyrinth, on the one hand, is process. You enter it, you walk. But if you are watching it, or if you just see it, it's all there. The whole thing is laid out.
Does the labyrinth have any physical, or the Bible have any reference to a physical labyrinth? I realize that we could talk, you know, about labyrinths in life and thinking
sure.
and religion.
Yes.
But was there any physical reference to
in the Bible?
Yeah.
Not that I know of. Not to a physical labyrinth.
Yeah.
What happens, as so often with Christianity, is that Christianity takes images from other traditions and superimposes upon them. Just as there's no mention of December 25th as the birthday of Jesus. Why December 25th? As the birthday of Jesus.
We voted on it.
We voted on it. And why not July 13th? Is there significance to the birth of Christ being at the end of December?
Solstice.
Absolutely. The feast day of John the Baptist is June 24th. It mirrors pretty much the birth of Christ. It's John the Baptist who says, I must decrease and he must increase. This is solar. This is the calendar. I was married on June 24th, which is how I remember it. Weird day. John the Baptist, marriage. Doesn't
no, thank you. Sorry.
Yeah.
Curious.
Yeah.
How did the Minotaur become the rose?
Ah, thank you for asking that question. Thank you for asking that question. That's right where we're going. It's interesting. At the center of the labyrinth at Chartres, there is this center, and it was originally apparently covered with a metal plate. And no one's absolutely certain what was there in the design. But it's believed that there was an image of Theseus slaying the Minotaur there. It's odd. Because really, what has happened with the labyrinth, as it is Christianized, is something very different. All you have to do is think about the way in which Jesus functions as a hero. Is Jesus like Theseus? I love doing this with my students.
That's tough.
Yeah.
But on the other hand...
Of course. There's a way in which yes, but there's a way in which no. That is, certainly he's not a traditional hero in the way we tend to define masculine heroes. And the way, in fact... people hoped and expected that he would be as Messiah, as Lord. That is, coming in, slay the Romans, reestablish the temple, and so on. Instead, what does Jesus do? He lets himself be crucified as a common criminal. This is not very heroic. With my students, it's often, if you grew up with Westerns the way I did, cavalry comes in, the hero comes in, John Wayne comes in, whoever it might be, and of course, and then has the battle, kills the bad guys, and there's tremendous applause.
Of course, he's slaying all the sins of the world.
Absolutely.
Which is
there's a way. But how does he do it?
Yes.
How does he do it?
A different procedure.
And so there is a transformation of that old image of the hero through this labyrinthine process. And so really, as you're walking the labyrinth at Chartres, or as you walk the labyrinth here, the idea is that it's just like as you enter the cathedral as a whole.
A transformation?
There is a transformation. There is a physical walk, but that physical walk is really all about this inner process. And of course, there's no guarantee. This is where we get into trouble all the time with ritual and so on. Jesus himself is adamant about it's not simply a matter of doing the outward forms. And this is Luther all over again. It's not just a matter of having a priest bless you or whatever it might be. There has to be an inner transformation. And yet, this is what makes me a liturgical person. I was raised Presbyterian and fell in love with the Anglican Church when I was living in England as an undergraduate. I said this last week, that for me, the simple act of being in church in England and literally kneeling at the altar and putting my hands out, that action, that physical action, spoke volumes to me about what I needed. What it said was, I cannot feed myself. I need the other. I need you. I need something to feed me. And so those physical actions were really important to me. Now, of course, I don't have to kneel. I don't have to put my hands out. But we are incarnate beings. We're physical beings. We really experience the spiritual to a great extent through the body. And the physical action of going to Chartres or walking to the labyrinth and then literally walking the labyrinth with the intention of surrender, the intention of opening myself. It's not magic, but there is something, many people say, there's something about walking this pattern that does feel like it realigns us. And symbolically, just as walking into Chartres, there is a kind of death, a kind of death. I'm qualifying it, a metaphor. Obviously not a literal death. And yet, you're crossing a threshold, another powerful archetype, a liminal place, or in the Celtic tradition, what they call a thin spot, a thin place. And we can all feel that when we arrive at places. And the labyrinth is like that. And so you stand at the threshold of the labyrinth, you pray, you offer, and maybe there's some particular intention, and then you begin the journey. And it is like Theseus. It is a thread, following a thread into the center, and trusting that as you walk, you are going to arrive at that center, even though you can't quite see. All you can do is go step by step. The wonderful Spanish poet Antonio Machado said, there is no road. The road is made by walking. You take one step. And this is true of our lives. I mean, it is an act of faith. Again, I deal with college students all the time. And they're anxious about what happens when I graduate. There is no road. The road is made by walking. You take one step. And how do you know what that step is? Well, it might be a digression, it may be going the wrong way, but if you are faithful, I really do believe that each of those apparently wrong steps is going to lead you deeper and deeper into the truth. And that's like this labyrinthine process, that even the apparent digressions ultimately become part of the journey. Even our sins, and this goes back to last week when I was talking about Dostoevsky, who really knew something about sin, even our sins, if we attend to them, become part of our journey, do they not? Often, the greatest addiction counselors are those who were addicts. They know something of that place. And so they can help others. And so you walk, and you enter that place. And on the one hand, there's the minotaur that you have to slay. And yeah, there is a heroic quality to that, to facing those sins. Jesus harrowing hell, the tradition, descending into the underworld and slaying sin. But he does it through an act of sheer surrender. Again, the cross is a powerful symbol of that. All you have to do is stand there like this, and you can feel the vulnerability. Even I'm not on a cross, but I can just feel it standing like this. I'm just wide open, wide open. In many traditions, bowing is a really important symbol of obeisance, obedience. in the Middle Ages, that a knight would bow to his liege lord and would be then blessed or would be admitted into, you know, the, you know, Arthur, you know, doing the sword to the knight.
Or his head cut off.
Exactly, exactly. See, that's it. That's what that bowing symbolizes. Yeah. You're like this, and what you're saying is, I am vulnerable to you. You have my life in your hands. Hmm. The act of bowing is that surrendering over. And so that's what Jesus slays precisely.
It doesn't come easy.
Huh?
It doesn't come easy.
No, it does not come easy. But that's the process. And so you move into that center, and the Minotaur, in a sense, of Theseus, is replaced with Christ. Theseus is an old model of the masculine hero who literally slays and, you know, becomes king, creates an empire, and so on. And that's a pattern that we see repeated over and over again. And in fact, I would make this huge leap and suggest that our attempts to create literal empires are attempts to find a substitute for this way of Christ that we really don't want to follow because it just is horrible. I mean, that's where Paul takes us. The crucified Christ is the sheer folly of love of God. Right? Paul got that big time. He really experienced that. And each of us, in our own way, probably has a taste of that. And yet, we know how hard it is still to follow it. And so, empire is this a literal form of, you know, we're gonna create a paradise. We're gonna create the kingdom on earth. We're gonna do it. The British Empire. The sun never sets on the British Empire. To return to that metaphor, literally, somewhere on the earth, the sun was shining on the British Empire. And they thought they were bringing light, enlightenment, Christian values, and so on. But of course, it was terribly mixed up with conquering and greed and so on. And so this labyrinthine process is the alternate way. And there's something, again, literally about walking that, that returns us, and I return to where I started with Merton, returns us to this sense of proportion and balance and harmony that is also that place of Christ. The labyrinth really is balanced, and I mean, you can see it from above, or if you walk it with other people. I love standing in a particular place and watching the movement.
There are other things besides the labyrinth that perform the same function in life.
Absolutely.
The paths that we take, the turns we make.
Yes. You can just see how the metaphors unfold.
Yeah, yeah.
The path, the turning, conversion, and so on. It's all, I mean, the labyrinth is an embodiment, physical embodiment of those metaphors, which is why it can be so powerful. Absolutely. Just to give one quick example, and then we'll stop. A number of years ago, I was up here at Holden with my wife and daughter. My daughter it was summertime, she just finished high school, was on her way to college. Talk about a threshold time. And the three of us, the morning we were going to be leaving Holden, walked out to the labyrinth together and walked it. And the pattern of the labyrinth, I wound up on, this would be the west side. I was there standing. I just stopped at some point and watched my wife and daughter. No one else was on it. I was at the west, and my wife and daughter were both moving towards the east. And my wife was over here, and there's a pattern where you move into the center and then move back out again. And my daughter was over here in the south, and she was also in a place where she was moving towards the center and then back out again. I'm standing here, and I watch my wife and my daughter meet and then go like that. And I cannot tell you, I've never forgotten it. Because it embodied that moment in our lives where my wife and my daughter were coming together and then separate paths. But remember that, of course, it all ends up at the same center. We're all there held in that dance together. And so, yes, we're all separate, we're all moving in our own way, but it's all part of this same ultimate pattern. It's really a beautiful, beautiful image, as my daughter was heading off into college. We'll stop there. Thank you.